Welcome to Astounding Stories of Space and Time. I'm Mardell, reading The Skylark of Space by E.E. Smith. Chapter 10. The great steel forgings, which were to form the framework of the Skylark, arrived and were hauled into the testing room, where radium capsule X-raying revealed flaws in every member. Seaton, after mapping the imperfections by orthometric projection, spent an hour with calipers and slide rule. Strong enough to stand shipment and fabrication, maybe a little to spare, perhaps 1G of acceleration while we're in the air, any real shot of power, though, or any sudden turn and pop, she collapses like a soap bubble. Want to recheck my figures? No, I told you not to bother about analysis. We want sound material, not junk. Ship 'em back, then, with an inspector? No. At Seaton's look of surprise, Crane went on. I've been thinking about this possibility for a long time. If we reject these forgings, they will immediately try to kill us some other way, and they may very well succeed. On the other hand, if we go ahead all unsuspectingly and use them, they will let us alone until the Skylark is done. That will give us months of free, undisturbed time, expensive time, I grant, but worth every dollar. Maybe so. As the money man, you're the judge of that. But we can't fly a heap of scrap, Mort. No, but while we're going ahead with this, just as though we meant it, we can build another one, about 4 times its size, in complete secrecy. Mort, you're talking like a man with a paper nose. How do you figure on keeping stuff that size secret from steel? It can be done. I know a chap who owns a steel mill, so insignificant, relatively speaking, that he has not been bought out or frozen out by steel. I have helped him out from time to time, and he assures me that he will be glad to cooperate. We will not be able to oversee much of the work ourselves, which is a drawback. However, we can get MacDougall to do it for us. MacDougall? The man who built Intercontinental? He wouldn't touch a little job like this with a pole. On the contrary, he is keen on doing it, if it means building the first spaceship. You know. He's too big to disappear, I'd think. Wouldn't Steele follow him up? They never have. A few times when he and I have been out of touch with civilization for 3 months at a time. Well, it would cost more than our whole capital. No more talk of money, Dick. Your contribution to the firm is worth more than everything I have. Okay, that's the way you want it. Tickles me, like I'd swallowed an ostrich feather. I can't think of any more objections. 4 times the size. Woo! A 2-pound 100-bar? Pow! And why don't we build an attractor, a thing like an object compass except with a 10-pound bar instead of a needle, so if anything chases us in space, we can reach out and shake the way out of it. Or machine guns shooting Mark 1s to 10s through pressure gaskets in the walls. I just bodaciously do not relish the prospect of fleeing from a gaggle of semi-intelligent alien monstrosities merely because I got nothing bigger than a rifle to fight back with. All you have to do is design them, Dick, and that shouldn't be too hard. But speaking of emergencies, the power plant should really have a very large factor of safety. 400 pounds, say, and everything in duplicate from power bars to push buttons. I'll buy that. Work was soon begun on the huge steel shell in the independent steel plant under the direct supervision of MacDougall, by men who had been in his employ for years. And while it was being built, Seaton and Crane went ahead with the construction of the original spaceship. Practically all of their time, however, was spent in perfecting the many essential things that were to go into the real Skylark. Thus they did not know that to the flawed members there were being attached faulty plates by imperfect welding, nor could they have detected the poor workmanship by any ordinary inspection, for it was being done by a picked crew of experts, picked by Perkins. To make things even, Steele did not know that the many peculiar instruments installed by Seton and Crane were not exactly what they should have been. In due course, the cripple, a name which Seton soon shortened to Old Crip, was finished. The foreman overheard a conversation between Crane and Seton, in which it was decided not to start for a couple of weeks, as they had to work out some kind of a book of navigation tables. Prescott reported that Steele was still sitting on its hands, waiting for the first flight. Word came from McDougal that the Skylark was ready. Crane and Seton went somewhere in the helicopter to make a few final tests. A few nights later, a huge ball landed on Crane Field. It moved lightly, easily betraying its thousands of tons of weight only by the hole it made in the hard-beaten ground. Seton and Crane sprang out. Dorothy and her father were waiting. Seton caught her up and kissed her vigorously. Then, a look of sheerest triumph on his face, he extended a hand to Vanaman. "She flies! How she flies! We've been around the moon!" "What?" Dorothy was shocked. "Without even telling me? Why, I'd have been scared peak green if I'd known." "Well, that was why," Seton assured her. "Now you won't have to worry next time we take off." "I will so," she protested, but Seton was listening to Vanaman. "It take not quite an hour. We could have done it in much less time." Crane's voice was calm, his face quiet, but to those who knew him so well, every feature showed emotion. Both inventors were at the summit, moved more than either could have told by their achievement, by the success of the flyer upon which they had worked so long. Shiro broke the tension by bowing until his head almost touched the floor. "Sirs and lady, I impel myself to state this to be wonderful extreme. If permitting, I shall delightful luxuriate in preparation suitable refreshment." Permission granted, he trotted away, and the engineers invited the visitors to inspect their new craft. Although Dorothy knew what to expect from the plans and drawings and from her own knowledge of Old Crip, she caught her breath as she looked about the brilliantly lighted interior of the great Sky Rover. It was a spherical shell of hardened steel of great thickness, some 40 feet in diameter. Its true shape was not readily apparent from inside, as it was divided into levels and compartments by decks and walls. Its center was a spherical structure of girders and beams. Inside this structure was a similar one which, on smooth but immensely strong universal bearings, was free to revolve in any direction. This inner sphere was filled with machinery surrounding a shining copper cylinder. Six tremendous fabricated columns radiated outward, branching in maximum strength design out to the hull. The floor was heavily upholstered and was not solid. The same was true of the dozen or more seats built in various places. There were two instrument boards on which tiny lights flashed, and plate glass, plastic, and metal gleamed. Both Vannemans began to ask questions, and Seton showed them the principal features of the novel vessel. Crane accompanied them in silence, enjoying their pleasure, glorying in the mighty ship of space. Seton called attention to the great size and strength of one of the lateral supporting columns, then led them over to the vertical column that pierced the floor. Enormous as the lateral was, it appeared puny beside this monster of fabricated steel. Seton explained that the two verticals had to be much stronger than the four laterals, as the center of gravity of the ship had been placed lower than its geometrical center, so that the apparent motion of the vessel would always be upward. Resting one hand caressingly upon the huge member, he explained exultantly that it was the ultimately last word in strength, made of the strongest known high-tensile heat-treated special alloy steel. "But why go to such an extreme?" the lawyer asked. "It looks as though it could support a bridge." "It could. It'll have to if we ever really cut loose with the power. Have you any idea of how fast this thing can fly?" "I have heard you talk of approaching the velocity of light, but that's a little overdrawn, isn't it?" "Not a bit. If it wasn't for Einstein and his famous theory, we could develop an acceleration twice as great as one light velocity. As it is, we're going to see how close we can crowd it. And it'll be close, believe me. Out in space, that is. In air, we'll be limited to 3 or 4 times sound, in spite of all we could do in the line of heat exchangers and refrigeration. But from what I've read about jets, 10 gravities for 10 minutes can be fatal." "That's right. But these floors are special, and those seats infinitely more so. That was one of our hardest jobs, designing supporting surfaces to hold a man safe through forces that would ordinarily flatten him out into a thin layer of goo." "I see. How are you going to steer? And how about a stable reference plane to steer by? Or are you merely going to head for Mars or Venus or Neptune or Aldebaran, as the case may be?" "That wouldn't be so good. We thought for a while we'd have to, but Mart licked it. The power plant is entirely separate from the ship, inside that inner sphere, about which the outer sphere and the ship itself are free to revolve. Even if the ship rolls or pitches, the bar stays right where it is pointed. Those 6 big jackets cover gyroscopes, which keep the outer sphere in exactly the same position." "Relative to what?" Vanneman asked. "It seems to have moved since we came in." "Yes, if you look closely, you can see it move." "Naturally, I never thought of it from that angle. Just that its orientation isn't affected by either ship or the power plant. If you want to pin me down, though, it's oriented solidly to the 3 dimensions of the steel plant at the time McDougal got the gyroscopes up to the holding speed. Since that doesn't mean much here and now, I'd say, as an approximation, that it is locked to the fixed stars, or rather to the effective mass of the galaxy as a whole." "Please, Dick," Dorothy interrupted, "enough of the jargon. Show us the important things. Kitchen, bedrooms, bath." Seaton did so, explaining in detail some of the many differences between living on Earth and in a small, necessarily self-sufficient worldlet, out in airless, lightless, heatless space.
"Oh, I'm just wild to go out with you, Dick. When will you take me?"
"Very soon, Dottie, just as soon as we're sure we've got all the bugs ironed out. You'll be our first passenger, so help me. How do you see out? How about air and water? How do you keep warm or cool, as the case may be?" Vanneman fired the questions as though he were cross-examining a witness. "Oh, no, excuse me, you've already mentioned the heaters and refrigerators." "The pilots see outside the whole sphere of vision by means of special instruments, something like periscopes, but vastly different. Electronic. Passengers can see out by uncovering windows. They're made of fused quartz. We carry air, oxygen, nitrogen, helium, and argon in tanks, although we won't need much new air because of our purifiers and recovery units. We also have oxygen-generating apparatus aboard for emergencies. We carry water enough to last us 3 months, or indefinitely if necessary, as we can recover all wastewater as chemically pure H2O. Anything else?"
"You'd better give up, Dad," Dorothy advised, laughing. "It's perfectly safe for me to go along."
"It seems to be, but it's getting pretty well along toward morning, Dorothy, and if any of us are to get any sleep at all tonight, you and I should go home."
"That's so. And I'm the one who's been screaming at Dick about going to bed every night at 11. I'll go powder my nose. I'll be right back.
Vanneman said after Dorothy had gone, You mentioned bugs only in a very light and passing way.
And you didn't mention them at all, Seaton countered.
Naturally not, with a jerk of his head in the direction his daughter had taken. Now how did it really go, boys?
Wonderful, really,
Dick began to enthuse. You tell me, Martin.
In the main, very well. Of course, this was a very short flight, but we found nothing wrong with the engines or their controls. We are fairly certain that no major alterations will be necessary. The optical system needs some more work. The attractors and compellers are not at all what they should be in either accuracy or delicacy. The rifles work perfectly. The air purifiers do not remove all odors, but the air after purification is safe to breathe and physiologically adequate. The water recovery system does not work at all. It delivers sewage.
Well, that's not too serious with all the water you carry.
No, but it malfunctions so grossly that some mistake was made, obviously. It should be easy to find and to fix. For a thing so new, we both are very well satisfied with its performance.
You ready for steel, then?
I don't know what they'll do when they find out that you don't intend to do anything with old Crip, but they'll do something.
I hope they blow their stacks, Seaton said grimly. We're ready for 'em with a lot of stuff they never heard of and won't like a little bit. Give us 4 or 5 days to straighten out the bugs Mark told you about. Then let 'em do anything they want to.
Please join me next time for more scientific spaceship stuff in The Skylark of Space by E.E. Smith, here on Astounding Stories of Space and Time. Until then, watch the skies. Thank you.